Hello, and welcome to our first ever live Brussels Sprouts episode. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today, we have the third episode in our series of podcasts looking at coronavirus and transatlantic relations. But today, we're doing this entirely differently. We're joined, as usual, by two fantastic guests who I will introduce in just a second. But rather than it just being Jim and I, we are joined by an entire virtual audience today. So after Jim and I get a chance to sit down and talk with Natalie and Constanza, we'll turn our hosting reins over to our audience and allow them to ask their own questions. So we're really excited about this. It's the first one out of the gates. We think it's going to be a lot of fun. So on that note, maybe I will go ahead and introduce our two guests. We are joined today by Natalie Tocci. She's the director of the Instituto Affari Internazionali, and she's an honorary professor at the University of Tübingen. She served as the special advisor to Federica Mogherini, the high representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. And she was an author of the Europe Global Strategy. We're also joined by Constanza Stelzenmüller, who is Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. She's the Kissinger Chair on Foreign Policy and International Relations at the Library of Congress, and she is the inaugural Robert Bosch Senior Fellow from 2014 to 2019. So with that, I think maybe just to get things rolling, Constanza, Natalie, maybe you can tell us a little bit about kind of how governments in Italy and Germany are handling the crisis. Talk about how the pandemic is shaping those dynamics. And I think in particular, you know, there's been really a lot of discussion about how coronavirus could be strengthening nationalism, strengthening anti-integration, anti-globalization forces, whether this pandemic is weakening democratic government. So just would love to hear from both of you how you think those dynamics are playing out in Italy and in Germany.
Okay, so perhaps to kick off on the Italian side, as you know, Italy was essentially the sort of next in line after China, alongside South Korea and Japan, of course, but the first European country in which this outbreak of the coronavirus took place. So essentially, when it happened, Italy has been, in a sense, sort of at the forefront of experimenting very much through, in some respects, trial and error. There was a progressive lockdown that was put in place that was eventually emulated basically by all other European countries, or most other European countries, as well as obviously the United States itself. And by and large, I would say that it was an interesting, sort of dramatically interesting experience, because it was basically the first time a lockdown happened in a way which in some respects was similar to the Chinese lockdown and therefore different from the South Korean and the Japanese lockdowns, but that was taking place in a democratic country. And what was interesting about it is that it really has relied a lot, and I think this is true for other European countries, probably true of the United States as well, it has relied a lot on citizenship, basically. So there has been a really quite remarkable degree of sort of citizenship responsibility. Now, of course, it's kind of, you know, partly driven by solidarity, probably partly obviously driven by fear as well. But basically, we don't really have, you know, sort of soldiers arresting people on the streets. I mean, yes, you know, you do see quite a bit of police. But by and large, it really relies upon sort of individual responsibility, individual and therefore collective responsibility. And I think this has been quite an interesting aspect. Now, obviously, sort of as we're now in, this is what, 4.5 weeks in lockdown, so it's beginning to take its toll. We're no longer in the phase of singing from balconies and clapping from our windows. So we're sort of moving into a different phase, which obviously is a much, much tougher one. But by and large, the measures are holding. There is now the beginning of the debate, which is likely going to be an even tougher debate than the one that we've had so far, in terms of how do we actually go about unlocking a lockdown situation? Because this, politically speaking, actually entails, in some respect, an even harder set of decisions, and certainly a riskier set of decisions, because, you know, which are the age groups, the sectors, the regions, the cities, the towns that you start unlocking, and where, what is the threshold of new contagions as well as deaths that you will tolerate in order to begin that unlocking process. So we're not obviously there yet, but we can see the beginning of the debate of this kind happening in Italy. Last point that I wanted to mention really goes to a point, Andrea, that you were mentioning, which really has to do with the question of nationalist populism, closure, etc. And I think this is also, I think, quite an interesting paradox that is beginning possibly to emerge. Because yes, you're absolutely right that on one level, you could see the risk of a situation such as this, which is all about closing up rather than opening, and that therefore heeds, in a sense, more to a nationalist, protectionist, etc. mindset. But you've actually been seeing how, at least in Italy, this is not a time that seems to favour nationalist politicians. Matteo Salvini, that, as you probably all know, was a sort of a nationalist superstar in the country, actually is not doing very well at the moment. The current approval ratings of our prime minister, that is certainly not a nationalist, I mean, he's a very sort of middle of the road, moderate, in fact, he's not even a politician, he's a lawyer by training. His approval ratings currently are 71%, which is really unheard of. So it seems to me that this is a time, I mean, I'd be interested to hear whether this is an Italian quirk or whether there is something a bit more general about it, a time in which public opinion wants to have, yes, firmness, but also reassurance. And it's that mix of reassurance and firmness that you don't really get from the sort of violent flip-flopping that, that often nationalist and populist politicians provide.
Do you want me to?
Yeah, chime in and kind of your view kind of from the German case? And yeah, it would be really interesting to hear, like Natalie was saying, how much of what she was saying in terms of, you know, not so much support for the nationalist governments, how much of that is a broader trend maybe that's playing out in Germany as well?
Sure. Well, let me start out with the government. As you, I'm sure you know, Germany is a federal state. And federalism is sort of a key element of our post-war constitution. And dealing with infections disease management is really a matter for the states and for the local communities. So the federal government initially was slow and reluctant to take the lead because it would have been a violation of the constitutional culture to go ahead and tell the states what to do. And this resulted in several weeks of sort of bickering between mayors. The mayor of Berlin said, we have to let our football games go on because FC Union is going to play Bayern Munich and people can't be deprived of that. And then on the other side, the minister president of Bavaria went ahead and just declared his own regional state of emergency, which meant that he could centralize power in his state. And then ultimately, it became clear that this wasn't going to be workable because there were different standards everywhere. And so about 10 days ago, Merkel, after a sort of long consultation with the minister presidents, which is like the governors of the states in Germany, went ahead and said, we are going to enact a nationwide, basically, lockdown, with closure of non-essential businesses, people having to stay at home, et cetera, et cetera. The other important thing was updating the National Infection Protection Act, which is what rules the statute that is applicable in times of a pandemic, allowing the federal government much greater powers for the duration of a year to give orders nationwide. Again, there is now a big discussion among constitutional lawyers about, you know, to the degree of the, to which that's constitutional and acceptable, but mostly people are going along with it. And perhaps keep in mind that all this is playing out in the context of what we thought was going to be a national power struggle for the succession of Angela Merkel, whose last term, as she has said, she won't run again after her fourth term, it ends sometime in the fall of 2021. And her heir apparent, the defense minister, Annegret Kamp-Karrenbauer, had stepped down as CDU leader in February, thus throwing open the race again for the CDU. And interestingly, several of the pretenders are either minister presidents, the one of North Rhine-Westphalia, Armin Laschet, the one in Bavaria, Markus Söder, although he says he isn't. And finally, the health minister himself, Jens Spahn. So there is an overlay of political power struggle here that you know people are also watching carefully. Now, as Natalie said, yes, there is a sort of distinct and really rather moving societal element to this. Two things, really. One, Germans turned out to be a little more anarchic than we had thought. In other words, Merkel had to give one speech in which she appealed to people's sense of responsibility and said, you know, I don't like giving orders. I come from the GDR. That's where I grew up. For me, freedom was all essential. And you guys are going to have to just, you know, please make up your own mind about what you're going to do. And that ended up not being enough. So that was when the government moved to this nationwide lockdown. Now, on the whole, I think you are seeing a lot of people sort of, you know, protesting against the, for example, the initial very nationalistic responses from the German government, not giving aid, closing down the borders, not sending aid to Italy and other hard hit countries. There has been a lot of movement against that by ordinary people, and thankfully the government has since changed its policy and has in fact started quite energetically, not just sending aid to neighboring countries, but also sending planes to pick up sick people from Bergamo and other places to treat them in Germany and from France. Thank God. I think otherwise I would have had a very hard time continuing being a German. Finally, there's an economic point which I'm sure we'll want to discuss as well before I get to the populist. Germany pulled out the so-called big bazooka. Basically, you know, the policy of the black zero, no government debt, which is actually a constitutional provision, is history. There is a huge amount of money being poured into the economy. And in several states, particularly apparently in North Rhine-Westphalia, civil servants are working round the clock to grant small businesses and independent business owners financial support. And apparently these requests have been granted within 24 hours or less, which is an extraordinary thing to happen in Germany's administrative state. And now on the populace, yes, amazingly, Merkel's popularity rate is higher than ever. The CDU has soared from somewhere like 26% to 36%. That's a 10% increase in the polls. The Social Democrats have not profited, the Greens have lost, and the AfD has moved under 10%. It was trending somewhere between 12 and 15. And indeed, the AfD has not been, you know, has I think shown again for anybody who needed to know that, that it has no constructive ideas for dealing with situations like this. But I want to warn that we should not assume that it's going to stay that way, because I think that this situation will create a great deal of economic and social hardship. And the populists, like the AfD and others, will try and make hay out of this. And we're only at the beginning of this story, so we shouldn't assume that this is how it's going to stay.
Yeah, those are great points, Jim. I see you.
As Andrea said, those are really great points. And in my mind, I kept seeing parallels with some of the trends that you see here in the United States. And so what I want to ask both of you, as you've looked at what the U.S. has been doing in terms of dealing with this virus, both what President Trump has done, some of the problems we've been running into, some of the reaction by the American population, where do you see there to be very similar trends, and where do you see there being actually not very similar at all between Italy, Germany, and the United States?
I mean, if I may on this, I think what's quite striking is that in terms of the US's domestic reaction, yes, perhaps there's been a sort of wider degree of oscillation between, you know, let's reopen immediately because our prime concern is the economy, through to, oh, actually, you know, we do need to continue in a lockdown for public health reasons. So there's been perhaps slightly more of an oscillation than has been the case, for instance, in Italy. But by and large, I don't see major differences. Yeah, so it's still about, obviously, depending on different degrees of and potential, but it is about fiscal stimulus. It is about sort of trying to sort of walk that fine line of what is the appropriate public health as opposed to economic sort of set of responses. So I don't see anything categorically different. What really does strike me as a difference, and it's not so much a difference between Italy, Germany, or the United States, but the United States today and the United States in the past, is really this theme about global leadership. Yeah. And there is where the United States is just, sadly, for someone who's always believed in it very much as myself, completely off the map. And what's striking to me is that it's not really a question of, whether one agrees or disagrees with what the United States does in the world. I mean, if you kind of, rewind back to, the degree of whatever public opposition in Europe to US foreign policy back in 2003, for example, huge, yeah? But there was no one questioning that even if, for reasons that we disagreed with, there was a very clear US leadership in the world. And now with this virus, COVID-19 is basically a crisis in which there is a complete absence of the United States in the world. So if I think about the debate here in Italy, for example, we talk a lot about Europe and, to what extent is there solidarity or not when it comes to Europe. There's been a lot of talk about China, to a lesser degree about Russia. The US has simply not been part of the debate. Yesterday there was the announcement of assistance coming from the medical equipment coming from the United States that was kind of welcome, but it came very late in the day. It has come very late in the day. So what strikes me when it comes to the US is the way in which COVID-19 risks being an inflection point in terms of the US's global leadership. Mm.
Constanza, maybe just to kind of continue down this thread a little bit, I mean, to what extent do you think, I mean, not to pick up on Natalie's point about whether or not this could be an inflection point, to what extent do you think that this pandemic, and in particular the United States response, including shutting down travel from Europe without consulting allies, how much additional damage do you think that this has done to an already strained relationship? And maybe if you can also kind of just weigh in, picking up on this China point, to see this in a geopolitical lens, clearly China is doing its best to present itself as a viable alternative to the United States as a responsible global leader. But yet we hear things about, its disinformation campaign, spreading false information, the fact that oftentimes the quality of its products is not, up to snuff. How are China's overtures being received in Europe? And do you think it is plausible that it could be that kind of inflection point with China really stepping in a more serious way to replace the U.S.
True. Well, you know what they say, that crises are clarifying moments for characters. And I think that's true for individual characters as well as for the characters of governments. And I think the past few weeks have really not told us much that we didn't already know. They've just clarified, and in sometimes exaggerated, almost dramatic, theatrical ways, what we thought we knew. Now, for the United States, to use an American expression, it is what it is. and I think European governments have become used, are less easily triggered by the behavior of the Trump administration, which is good, because we don't have time for irrelevant, for all of us getting, as it were, the vapors over stuff that we already knew was going to happen. But I want to remind us that a lot of European governments and nations have relationships at the subfederal level in this country, and that there may be a lot going on there that sort of is less visible to the public right now. And I suspect, in the same way that this administration has triggered a sort of a states' rights movement, in the sense that some states and even Republican governors or Republican mayors have said, well, you may abrogate the Paris Agreement, but we're sticking with it. I think that movement is going to gain strength in this country, and that I think means that European governments and societies will be looking to connect with states and municipalities at least as much as they do with the government. Now, would it in an ideal world be nice to have American leadership? Yes. But frankly, I would also like to see more EU leadership and European leadership. And we haven't been seeing enough of that either. As for the Chinese, I think that for anybody, who is a literate watcher of Chinese diplomatic behavior and rhetoric on the international stage, if anything, the Chinese have clarified what they're about, which is that they are using humanitarian aid and international relations to help in their ascent to a position of, I won't say world domination, but of a global power to be reckoned with and competing with the United States. Now, I think the Europeans are not naive about this, and the Huawei debate, the tussles about Huawei, I think taught us a great deal about the ruthlessness of Beijing, and the intentions of Beijing. So I think the people who are in government positions are unlikely to find the Chinese behavior right now seductive in any way. And I frankly don't get the impression that it's been working very well, except in sort of, very, very unique cases. The Serbian prime minister praising the Chinese for their help. The Chinese spent a long time investing in Serbia, as have the Russians. But I don't think that this is a Europe-wide phenomenon. I would say the contrary is the case. If anything, it's becoming clear that this is not a benign relationship.
That's fascinating. I've been thinking quite a bit about China, and of course Andrea has been as well. We had a podcast, our last podcast talked about some of that, kind of a new variant on the Silk Road, if you will. But let's go back to U.S. Leadership just for a second, because I was trying to think back. So what would I, looking at how past presidents have led, what does that U.S. leadership look like at a time like this? The easy thing, of course, is in a mental picture of C-17s taking off for Europe and other places, loaded to the gills with masks and this kind of thing. And of course, we don't have enough of those ourselves. But there is an aspect of leadership that's not in a material way. It's a morale, or there's a there's a way in which you lead that doesn't mean handing things out. And so
that, by example,
By
example.
Yeah, by example, for sure. And but I was trying to think, what would U.S. leadership right now look like in a case like this, where we're not going to be filling C-17s because we've got our own problems. So what does it look like? Is it an American president calling the nations together for a meeting, kind of going back to the G20 idea? What does it look like? Is it the U.S. convening? Is it a speech? I think of John F. Kennedy, his speech during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So what does U.S. leadership look like? What would you all expect from the United States at a time like this? What does that look like?
Yeah, Jim, I mean, I agree with you. It's you're right in the sense that there are, China did have two and has had two big comparative advantages in this. Yeah, I mean, it has the advantage of being the manufacturing hub of the world, and therefore that it had stuff to send out more so than anyone else, which then brings, you know, sort of leads us to a more long-term question about sort of long, you know, sort of redundancies in the international economic system and the future of globalization, etc. The other big comparative advantage that the Chinese had was the fact that they were first in the line. And therefore, they did have a degree of expertise that neither the US nor Europeans had in terms of how to handle this. But I think you point towards the big thing that the United States could have done, and it's simply not in the DNA of this administration to do, which is the global governance bit. So right. It is, yes, you know, partly about the message of empathy and solidarity, but I think most importantly, it's about global coordination. Yes, it's true that this is a crisis that requires temporary closures, but in order to be effective, these closures have to be coordinated. They require cooperation. So this is true both from the sort of strict public health emergency, and perhaps even more so it will be true when it comes to coordinating the global economic response so as to at least mitigate the effects of what is likely going to be a very severe economic depression. Now, this is basically what the G20 did back in times of the global financial crisis. But where is the United States when it comes to these mechanisms of global governance? Well, it's nulle part at the moment, for the simple reason that in the United States, there is an administration that not only does not believe in global governance, but has actually seen in the rules-based multilateral system a major source of constraint, if not adversary.
Yeah.
Well, look, and if I might add, Jim, this is an administration that calls COVID-19 a foreign virus. Or the Wuhan virus. Remember, there was no G7 declaration.
Right.
Because the Secretary of State insisted on calling this the Wuhan virus, and the other leader said, we're not going along with this, we're not doing this. I mean, I think that makes the question of U.S. leadership at this point kind of moot. And so again, you know, that doesn't absolve anybody else in the world from stepping up to the plate. And as I said, I would like to see the Europeans do more. In an ideal world, I would like to see U.S. leadership. But I think we're not in that ideal world right now, and it's pointless to do hypotheticals, in my view. And again, it doesn't absolve anybody else. The thing that I also want to, I'd like to, if I might, raise another issue that we haven't talked about yet, and which maybe is dearer and nearer to this administration's heart, which is the, if you will, the effectiveness and the legitimacy of the nation state under these conditions. And I think we've learned two really important things, which is that sophisticated Western post-industrial nations have real problems with state, nation state functionality and legitimacy at this point for a variety of reasons. And that's, I think, true for the United States, as it is true for, I think, all of the European countries in different ways. We're all struggling, and we've all had to realize that, we have underinvested in key aspects of the functionality and the legitimacy of what remains, even in the European Union, the key unit of accountability, which is the nation state. So that's one thing. And that's a really big pill to swallow for all of us, I think. And I think that in a sort of post-crisis future would be, I think, a very good and useful thing to talk about.
Yes.
Between Western democracies.
Yes.
But the other thing, of course, that we've also learned is that, and again, Europe is a really good example for this, is that some nation states are stronger than other nation states. And even for the nationalists in Europe, they're having to realize that some of the smaller and less economically strong countries in Europe are de facto dependent on the bigger ones. Yeah, in almost every key way. And that gives a degree of responsibility to the largest economies and the powerful states, including mine, Germany, which I think we also haven't quite bent our minds around yet. And I think that's an argument to be deployed in the context of how to manage the economic crisis that we're now in. But it also ought to play a role in foreign and security policy and so on. So in other words, even if we were, I'm, as you probably know, not one of the sort of, you know, the flag waving nationalists. But I do believe in functioning and effective states. And there, I think the nationalists actually, I think, have very little to say about this, because what they're really about is capturing privilege and power, and not so much about creating a decent nation state.
It was incredibly
just putting
well
that out there.
Yeah, very well said, yeah. Constanza. I feel like we could ask 100 more questions, but Jim, I think it's time for us to relinquish our co-hosting reins and go
as
to
hard as that is.
Now the live part of the Brussels Sprouts programming here. And I know, so I did see Fran's hand up first. So Fran, over to you.
Sure. This is Fran Burwell at the Atlantic Council. Can you all hear me?
We can.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. So two questions. One is, we've seen quite a lot of border closings, and I'd like to put this in the context of Constanza's remarks about she'd like to see more EU, a greater European Union response. So we've seen quite a number of border closings. The EU closed its external borders in an effort to prevent internal border closings, but it hasn't worked. How do you expect this to work going forward? Is this going to be something that is more permanent? Schengen also always has had an emergency ability to close borders and has done so for summits and other things like that. But how, or are we seeing the economic challenges that come from border closings and that will rebalance the situation once the crisis has passed? The second question is about, and I'm very glad we have an Italian and a German here, because it's about the North-South divide. And we've seen this particularly on the economic side, although it hasn't been the Germans so much as the Dutch over the last week, who have been in fights with those in the South. And I'm wondering whether you see, is this the crisis point that gets us to a resolution of the North-South divide that emerged so strongly from the 2008 financial crisis? Or is this a feature that is likely to get even worse in the internal EU debates? Thanks.
Thanks, Fran. Over to both of you, Constanza and Natalie.
Okay, let me start. Fran, I doubt that the border closings are going to stay for the simple reason that we are so economically integrated with each other. That it would be, you know, economic suicide to do that to the border trade and to border labor movements, which are huge. Germany borders 9 countries in Europe, and I think and has outsourced a lot of its labor and a lot of its manufacturing to neighboring countries, particularly in Eastern Europe. It would be literally suicidal for German car parts manufacturers, for example, to do that. So I don't see that happening, frankly. And I don't see, you know, and a lot of people are talking now about repatriating supply chains. I just don't see that happening. I think that there might be some of it, but not all of it. I don't think that economic integration is something that can really realistically be rolled back. As for the North-South divide, I grinned when you mentioned the Dutch. I find this debate lamentable because it strikes me as being in many ways a false dichotomy. Yeah, I think it's clear that we need some kind of a mutualized and Europeanized economic mechanism. And I find it unhelpful for the German government to keep referring to the ESM because the ESM mechanism is connected to the stigma of a very strict conditionality. And it's been applied into the past to Greece and others with the sort of strict orders to conduct extremely painful austerity reforms. So I would say the ESM mechanism is an unhelpful framework to refer to, I mean, both in terms of political symbolism and in terms of the mechanics involved. This is an external shock. It's nobody's fault. I mean, yes, some economies are weaker than others, but we're not going to engage in a blame game here. But on the other hand, I also see the issuing corona bonds, which essentially would be relying on the German economy for their validity, would be hugely expensive for the German economy in ways that I think people haven't done the numbers on. German newspapers have. So I think what we might need is a sort of compromise in the middle, you know, a unified European economic effort that is based on a new financial design rather than on the old mechanism of the ESM or the notion of corona bonds.
Natalie, do you want to add?
Yeah, just to chip in on this. I mean, on the border question, I would say that indeed, I mean, in sort of the temporary border closures obviously are inevitable. I mean, it's not just closures of borders between countries, but also within countries and between individuals. So to me, the big question, which has to do not only obviously with the extent to which Schengen internally will hold, but above all with the identity, I guess, really, of the European Union externally, is the extent to which these closures are coordinated or uncoordinated closures. A coordinated temporary closure is just part of life at the moment, everyone's life. But to the extent to which it's coordinated and after, you know, when it comes to the EU, after the initial sort of uncoordinated ad hoc measures, indeed there has been coordination. So I'm not particularly concerned about the degree to, you know, so the hold basically of the Schengen zone. I am more concerned about the instinct, because indeed it fuels existing dynamics of closure towards the outside world. And by existing dynamics, I sort of only need to refer to what was happening a month ago, which now seems like a year ago, about, you know, the Commission president referring to a shield at the Greek-Turkish border. So my fear is when it comes to the attitudes towards the external side, the COVID-19 moment is simply going to fuel that fortress Europe, if you like, attitude, which already existed, unfortunately, before this crisis took place. Now, when it comes to the economic side, there I agree with, let me perhaps do the German, given that Costanza played the Italian on this. I agree with Costanza that this represents a crisis basically to finish the unfinished business of the Eurozone crisis that stemmed from the global financial crisis, and that basically Europe just kind of gets its act together only when it is confronted by a crisis. And that unlike the Eurozone crisis, there is not the moral stigma that created so much resistance, basically, to solidarity. Because it isn't a question of kind of, you know, lazy Southerners not doing, you know, sort of doing their reforms and, you know, as opposed to virtuous Northerners. I mean, this is obviously, you know, a crisis that affects everyone. And if it affects some more than others, to a very large extent, it's also bad luck, basically. So there isn't that same moral stigma. I see why there is a greater potential, basically, to finish that unfinished business today than there was 10 years ago. But I think in order to do so, and this is where Nathalie the German comes in, arguing against Lufthansa the Italian, is that I think we should, those of us that do want to move towards, whether they're corona bonds, euro bonds, but basically towards a greater mutualization, basically, of economic responsibility, we should be moving out of a very politicized black and white debate, which is basically what the Italians and the Spaniards and the French did last week. And I think it was a very high risk strategy doing it the way they did it, and bringing it down to a more palatable technical discussion in which the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, may be part of that solution. Because of course, when we talk about things like corona bonds, we should also be talking about the question of who is actually going to issue these bonds. And you know, for those who say, well, it's the Commission that is going to issue them, well, this would kind of require a revision of the treaties, which is not the kind of thing that we really could be doing now. So actually, there is a body that could be doing it, and it's precisely the ESM. So this would be, in a sense, so I guess what I'm saying here, and I'm not an economist, so I shouldn't probably get into the details of this, but I think once we get away from the black and white Eurobonds yes or no debate, down to the technical,
agreed,
how is it we can use, revise, and perhaps invent new instruments, given that I think in principle, politically speaking, there is a greater readiness actually to show solidarity because there isn't the moral stigma that was there during the Eurozone crisis. I think there is an opportunity to, quote unquote, to use the trite phrase, you know, use this crisis as an opportunity in a way which wasn't there in the past.
That's great. Okay, a couple more questions. Giovanna, you are next.
This is Giovanna De Maio, visiting fellow at Brookings. Thank you, Andrea, for hosting this, and Jim for hosting this, and thank you, Constanze and Nathalie. Well, this was fascinating just to learn and hear from you. I have two questions for Nathalie, picking up on China's projection in Italy. Basically, it has, in connection with this discussion of on euro bond, on corona bonds. So I was wondering, what's the sentiment now in Italy about China as a humanitarian superpower versus European Union that is not helping, and how do you envisage this going forward for Italy's relations in the Italy's role in the EU and Italy's relation with China? And then a second question about the rumor about Mario Draghi, former president of the European Central Bank, to be sooner or later, when this crisis is over, called to head a technical government in order to drive the country out of the crisis. I was just wondering what you thought about it, how real it is, and also what this would mean for democracy, since the populists have been arguing against any sort of bureaucracy or technocratic government that followed the 2008 economic crisis, and how this would be politically justifiable today. Thank you so much.
So perhaps first on the Draghi question and then China. On the Mario Draghi question, I don't see this happening anytime soon. Firstly, because I mean, actually, in many respects, I think Conte has, during this crisis, and I was hinting at this earlier, become a more popular prime minister than what he was a month ago. So I don't think that his leadership is actually being questioned. Secondly, obviously talking about a bit of change of government in this context is, sort of fanciful at best. And we don't really know how long this moment, which is then gets to the deeper problem, we don't really know how long this moment is going to last, you know. In the best of circumstances, a post-COVID-19 world will begin sort of, you know, the debris will start settling after the summer. In a less optimistic scenario in which there is a second round of an outbreak of the crisis in autumn, we're at best going, I mean, basically we're talking about until when a vaccine is available, and this could be, you know, probably sometime in the new year. And, you know, when things move so fast, and, you know, literally from one week to the next, we, all of our societies are changing so profoundly that I think sort of thinking about a future government when that dust settles, which could be as far away as 6, 8, 9 months' time, is very complicated. Which kind of also connects me to the China question that you're asking, although there isn't an obvious connection here. But simply to sort of go back to this point that attitudes change very, very fast. So yes, there was a sort of great deal of gratitude, I would say, towards China when, you know, the sort of planes came in and the medical teams came and the masks and, I mean, all the stories that you know. There was never, I mean, Italians were never naive about it. So it was always very clear that, of course, China was doing it because not out of altruism, but because it has an interest in doing so. But then again, who doesn't, you know? So there was always a sort of a degree of sort of pragmatism in the way in which this was viewed. And Italians were certainly not starry-eyed about it. But to me, the big point, which connects to the link that you were making to Europe, and I would add the United States as well, to me, the attitudes towards China or towards Russia in Italy or in any other country depend not only with how we view what China or others are doing, but in particular how we view this in relation to how the traditional allies and partners are behaving. So, you know, I think Italian attitudes, for instance, as I was saying earlier, when it comes to the US, off the map. And so the Chinese leadership it is more visible than what it would have otherwise been because there is an absence of another global leader. When it comes to Europe, I think, you know, this kind of, we're in stage three, hopefully we're going to get to a stage four. You know, stage one was silence, unilateral sort of border closures, export restrictions, Europe has abandoned us. Huh? Then there was kind of moment two of Europe is back, you know, 37 billion by the European Commission, 750 billion extra temporary asset purchases by the European Central Bank, sidelining of the Stability Pact, Europe is back. Now, you know, since the failure of the Eurogroup and the European Council meeting last week, again, we're in this lack of solidarity mode, which, you know, if I hope I'm right in what I was saying sort of earlier in response to the economic question, if we can find a technical way of finding a compromise, then the mood will change again. So today, snapshot of today, there is probably a greater appreciation of a China than there was last week, and that there may be next week if Europe is perceived as being back on track.
Thanks, Natalie. And I think we've got time maybe for two more questions. So first up is Amanda.
I had a question for you about potential authoritarianism coming out of this crisis. And there's two aspects. One is on the government side. We've seen in recent days, Orban in Hungary seeming to make a power grab. There's debate going on in Poland about whether or not to go forward with elections despite the coronavirus situation. And then And the second half of my question concerns the debate that we are seeing over surveillance, over questions about privacy rights. A number of countries, including both Germany and Italy, have imposed strict conditions in terms of people's movements with very heavy fines in some cases. So would be interested in your thoughts on both of those issues.
Well, if I may, those are all both really good questions that I've been thinking about as well. I had said earlier, maybe you weren't there yet, that the at least in Germany, the populists are currently in something of a trough. And the thing that I forgot to mention when I said that was that just before this crisis broke out, the German government had finally decided to move on the hard right wing of the AfD and put them under surveillance, upon which that wing proclaimed that it was going to dissolve, which frankly nobody in Germany believes, I think, because they are now they're basically running the party. So that was just a sort of a kabuki move. The Orban question, I have to say, concerns me greatly, because that is, obviously bad for Hungarian civil society, which, as we've seen in recent Hungarian municipal elections, still exists and is sort of happy to, and in fact, managed to elect a non-Fidesz mayor in Budapest, which was a remarkable event. But it also, of course, raises yet again the question of European censure. It frankly also raises the question of censure in within NATO. Unfortunately, NATO has practically no mode of censure available to it in its treaty, and the EU does in Article 7, but it's a particularly unwieldy one. We've already been working on that. It really doesn't work politically, and in both cases, the Hungarians have allies, mainly the Poles, who will stand by their side. In the EU, however, I will also say, at the risk of Germany bashing yet again, that it's the longtime support of Merkel's CDU and the European People's Party in the European Parliament that has led to Hungary getting away with this for so long. And I was dismayed by Ursula von der Leyen's recent statement, in which she didn't even name Hungary, just said it was important, for European countries to abide by European values. I find that just craven under the circumstances. And I think the time for that is over. But I would also like to see a political motion of censure, even if it's not unanimous, in the North Atlantic Council. I think that this kind of stuff is stunning and absolutely unforgivable. And I think that our colleague Tom Wright has suggested that Article 5 might be differently applicable in the case of democracies and non-democracies. That's a really, really hot, a hot idea. But I think that I'm not quite willing and able to go down that road, but I think a sharp censure is and consequences for our relationships with Hungary is really important. And I would point out that it has been really disappointing that this administration in Washington has not had anything to say about that, whereas members of Congress had. The biosurveillance point, Amanda. I'm currently writing something about that. That's a really, really important question right now. The German government has recently tightened the Infection Protection Act. I already mentioned that. And the health minister, Jens Spahn, tried to put a provision in there which would have allowed for cell phone tracking in a way that has proved quite successful in South Korea, but that by German standards would be unconstitutional. And what we're now discussing is a mode of tracking that's depersonalized, and that, in other words, is viable in constitutional terms and still helps with tracking the course of the epidemic. Forthcoming publication.
But just to go on about your point on NATO, that has been bouncing around Twitter quite a bit. Both Tom as well as others have been talking about what do you do with an ally whether it's Turkey or anybody else, that's beginning to veer off the road when it comes to democracy and that type of thing. And what Tom suggested is something that, you're right, it is a pretty powerful thing. But what I would like to say is there are things that we can do. And I, you know, your point about the NAC, I think, is important. And I think the SecGen can also say some things. The SecGen can certainly come out with a statement, or maybe NATO EU together can, either publicly or behind the scenes. And I think the problem is it is too easy for us to just dismiss and say, well, you know, in NATO, we can't do it. It's impossible. Well, yes, it's very difficult. As we've talked about, you know, with consensus, it's hard for NATO to sanction. But there's a lot of things that NATO can do that we just haven't given enough thought to. And so that's something coming out of this rise in nationalism, but particularly what we're seeing with Orban, that we have got to be put our mind to, because it's gotten to a point where we, by sitting it out and not saying anything, we're becoming part of the problem within the alliance. And I think we've got to start thinking about this. And perhaps this reflection time that the SecGen has kicked off is a point where we need to start talking about that.
All right, let's do one last question. Rachel.
Hi, Rachel Rizzo here. Hope everyone's doing well. I'm calling in from Salt Lake City, Utah with my parents. everyone's excited to listen to you guys. I have a quick question about how you think this will change the transatlantic relationship going forward more broadly. And this is for both Natalie and Constanza. In my opinion, the U.S.-European partnership is often viewed through this sort of narrow lens of security and defense, with NATO being the unofficial foundation of the relationship. And the transatlantic partners often spend time talking about Russia or U.S. troops in Europe or European defense spending. At least that's been the driving rhetoric of the Trump administration. But in a time like this, I think we find that those issues sort of drop to the bottom of the priority list. So I'm curious as to how you think the coronavirus will affect the transatlantic relationship in the long term. And do you think this might provide an opportunity for the transatlantic partners to recalibrate their priorities? And if so, what do you think that might look like?
It's a perfect question to end on. So over to you, Natalie and Constanza.
Well, I think it will be perhaps surprising that I think it could really go in two diametrically opposite directions. I mean, I think in many respects, what this crisis does is exacerbates existing trends. And there is both one trend, which is unfortunately the one that we've been seeing over the last 4 years, which is one that has been increasingly severing relationships across the Atlantic, be it in, you know, trade, security, political, social terms. And obviously you can see this crisis doing a lot more of that. You know, certainly the fact that exactly what we were discussing earlier, the fact that there was a unilateral travel ban that was not even discussed with Europeans, that there was exactly an understanding of a foreign virus that, yes, was a Wuhan virus, but it was kind of foreign because it was also a European virus, or it is also a European virus. So there's that had been fueling a lot of the existing tensions that existed. But I think at the same time, there is a lot of possible reconciliation and moving forward together that can be done if there is a leadership that is willing to go that way. Because it's very clear that this is a crisis which highlights even further, not only the need for cooperation at the global level, be it in terms of coordination of economic policies or sort of, you know, best practices on public health, but also the very specific challenges which are in the sort of digital, political, and security, as well as economic realms, of how do liberal democracies deal with a global pandemic such as this? You know, where do we stand in the sort of, you know, in the debate between, you know, privacy and security, particularly if interpreted in health terms? So how do we deal with the security implications? How do we coordinate our economic measures? How do we go about providing those redundancies in the international system and in the international economic system, because actually we can no longer afford to have China only as being the manufacturing hub in the world. I mean, all this is sort of, you know, is a very long and rich menu for transatlantic dialogue and cooperation. But in order to sort of sit down and have that cooperation. You need to have governments that are willing to have it and ready to do what it takes to rebuild a relationship. And that obviously depends, unfortunately, with who's going to be sitting in the White House.
Let me just add one or two points. Rachel, I read your very nice Bell Foundation piece in which you argue that the transatlantic relationship should in the future be about things like climate change and migration and other issues raised by globalization. I think that's, you know, that's entirely right. I think if anything, this crisis shows us that, you know, we are locked together by the destiny of being citizens of this planet. Yeah. And that we need to achieve two things at the same time, which is to be, you know, to make sure that we live in decent functioning nation states and cooperate with each other regionally and globally and in the transatlantic relationship where our circumstances force us to. And the problem with the nationalists and the populists, some of whom are in government in Western societies, I'm not naming names here, is that they appear to be either in denial of this fundamental fact of our lives, or they actually think they can turn it back. Which is and I think that we're learning right now that that's a fallacy. Yeah, but I would also say, you know, I think it would be an illusion to think that we won't need the military aspects of this anymore. Yeah, I think we will need them. And you know, there have been a lot of discussions with past American governments about extending the transatlantic relationship to other issues. And I think the Obama administration took this very, very far, made enormous efforts to extend the American-European relationship beyond the merely military and security. And a lot of that was greatly appreciated and actually worked. Yeah. And I'm guessing that future American presidents might want to return to those considerations. But again, it doesn't absolve us Europeans from doing more in our own space.
Jim, over to you.
Yeah, and I'll make it really quick, but Constanza, I agree with you completely. And I've been thinking about Rachel's very good question and a lot of what Rachel has been writing and about this as well. We have to build on what we know worked that we set up after World War II, which is one of those cataclysmic events that leads to great change. I wouldn't put this virus on that scale, but it's on a large enough scale so that we have to rethink not just what we do domestically, but we got to think about what we do globally. And for us who do this kind of work, the transatlantic side of it is where we can come up with we can come up with approaches that build on what we know has worked since having built it after World War II. We know that we can convene around a table the way we've done at NATO and work together on a problem. And I think we have to broaden this idea of what security, the definition of security. And we've got to find ways in which the EU and NATO and the transatlantic nations, to start with, can convene and deal with whether it's climate change or other things. We do a lot of that ad hoc. We do that behind closed doors. We do it in the G20, that type of thing. But I think we've got to do a better job of institutionalizing a more efficient approach, not building another big bureaucracy. We have another headquarters somewhere that looks like the new NATO building. I would just croak. But we've got to come up with an efficient way. Maybe it's Zoom. Maybe we have a big Zoom and everybody zooms in. I don't know. But Rachel, I think you're right. And Constanza, I think I agree with you completely. And the next president is going to have to think about this. And if I have my way, he or she will.
Oh, well, this has been such a rich discussion. What a great first go out of the gates with doing this live with questions from participants. It definitely just added so much richness to this discussion. We appreciate everyone's questions and hope that folks will join us again in the future. But for now, Constanza, Natalie, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. It really was a wonderful discussion, and we're looking forward to getting this episode out to our listeners, and hope we can do it again with you at some point soon.
Thank you for having us. This was great. Lovely to see you.
Thank you.